seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it.
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course, that's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course, we want to play at the weekend.
Hello there. You're welcome along to Golf Weekly. We are, well, not far away from the Masters now. We have a WGC World Match Play event ongoing. This is Thursday lunchtime as we record Irish time. Alongside me in studio, Nathan Murphy.
How are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm all right.
Good. And Fionn Davenport, you're there?
Hey, lads.
You were over in Dublin recently.
I was. I was over for the weekend.
Received a warm welcome.
I did, actually. So every time I come home these days, I rent a car, and I've been renting from Hertz for quite a long time. So I go to the airport, I pick up my car, I generally get the key with the envelope, and I don't really pay it no mind. I just take it, say thanks to the lads, and go downstairs to the car park and pick up my car. So I did the same, and I went downstairs and I looked to see what the car reg was so I would know. And instead of in the spot where it says car reg was written friend of the pod.
Amazing.
But here's the thing, right? Like, I had no idea until I got downstairs. So like the guy who gave it to me never said anything.
Starstruck.
No. You see,
tongue-tied
it was like.
And starstruck.
No, it was just like. I'd like to think that whoever you are, you mysterious fan of the pod, it's the absolute essence of coolness.
It's and so by, cool.
By pure coincidence, I was reading on Twitter this week that Ed Solomon, who wrote Men in Black and was a TV and movie writer who had worked with Gary Shandling for a number of years, he told this anecdote on the third anniversary of Gary Shandling's death that testified to what a cool guy Gary Shandling was. And it was basically this. A number of years ago, while he was working on something, he was standing on a set wearing a T-shirt that says, "This is Gary Shandling's T-shirt." And about an hour later, Gary Shandling shows up on the other side of the street wearing a T-shirt that says, "This is Ed Solomon's T-shirt." But never referenced the joke. Not once. Mm. Didn't go, aha, or never acknowledge it. And so Ed Solomon's argument was that it was like this idea that by going so far to build and then play the visual gag, you obviously had to go away and get a T-shirt done up with your man's name on it. Just for an audience of one, it was like it wasn't that Gary was showing up for the laughs. He was showing up for that moment of anticipation. And the way Ed Solomon, and you can look for his name on Twitter and you can see the thread of the story told, but it illustrates what a genius Gary Shandling was. And just by pure fluke, I had read that earlier that day, gotten the car key and this kind of mysterious note with friend of the pod on it. And it was the first thing I thought about. It was just like, it was the coolest thing I'd seen.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
A warm shout out to our friend at Hertz. That was a touch of cool. And the picture is on the Twitter feed if you want to look. We put it up there just so you could see that. Can I give a shout out to a Roisin Farron, by the way? We were doing a road show last night at the Olympia Theatre for Off the Ball. And at the end, we always get two contestants up to compete for a prize. In this case, it was a trip to the Heineken Champions Cup final. And there's always a bit of commotion for a minute or two as we set up the stage. And the two contestants made their way up. And I didn't, you know, I was getting quiz questions ready. I didn't even pay too much heed to them. And I just heard a female voice behind me go, friend of the pod, by the way. And
brilliant.
It was Roisin Farron. And she went and destroyed the opposition in the quiz. I mean,
Did her question suddenly become a whole lot easier?
No, she was phenomenal. The other bloke, Brendan, found himself in a position where he had the quick fire round, 9 questions, and he was already 9 points behind.
Oh, no. Wow.
She was awesome.
I must give a shout-out. Now I feel bad because you're so good. Well, Fionn, you don't know the name of your Hertz guy, so I guess it's okay.
That's the coolest part of Fionn's story.
I was in Gibraltar last week for the Ireland International.
Yeah.
And I met...
John Delaney.
John Delaney, who turns out is a big friend of the pod, and says he's going to have a lot of time for golf lately, so he's keen to come on and maybe bring us out.
Not a fan of tennis.
Certainly not. If they started throwing golf balls, it mightn't be quite as funny.
No.
That's next. So
what happened?
I would say I met 15 friends of the pod.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Full-time whistle, there was, I think, five people came up to me at the full-time whistle to the side of the press box, shouted over, friend of the pod!
That's so good.
And obviously, an awful lot of them are, because Gibraltar's this bizarre place that's just full of traders and betting companies where they have their base. They all live just above Gibraltar, where there's loads of really nice golf courses. Okay. Valderrama's around there.
Right.
And a lot of them play their golf there. I also met a couple of other people who I was walking along on the Friday night with our colleague Dan McDonald, who shouted, up Mayo! And I said, all right, lads. Got a text message from somebody half an hour later saying, two lads shouted up Mayo to you and thought you were a bit snobby. And a bit of a dickhead.
Oh my goodness.
Oh dear. The mask slips. The truth is out there.
Yeah. Come on.
That's Murphy for you.
If they said friend of the pod, I would have stopped and had a chat for half an hour.
It's true. Off the ball listeners, jog on. Golf Weekly listeners, come on in.
There's just something friendlier about Golf Weekly listeners.
They've had to seek us out.
Because what I notice is, and you probably noticed this as well, so I was near Irish bars about 3 hours before kickoff, and everybody's pissed, except me, because I'm working. And basically all anybody who listens to Off the Ball shouts is something semi-abusive. Oh, off the ball! Oh, ready, love game on! And everyone laughs. Golf Weekly listeners always come up and are like, friend of the pod, how are you getting on?
Totally
love
true.
It. Are you here for long? What are you doing? Where are you staying? Are you around for a few days? You want to play a bit of golf? What's like, yeah.
Off the ball is bigger than all of us. Mm. Not ours. We're an intrusion. But Golf Weekly is a bit different.
After all these years, I think it's a question of perspective as well, because the three of us generally operate out of this relatively small studio, so it always makes me happy and surprised to hear that we have listeners beyond these four walls.
I know, it's great.
Like, for instance, remember a few weeks ago I mentioned, I think, Joe, you'd asked me a question at the end of one pod, and I mentioned a friend of mine, Ben Pauker, who works for Vox.com in America, and I quoted. And so I got an email last week from Ben saying, oh, I heard my name was mentioned on a Irish golf podcast. And as it turns out, we have a listener to the podcast, a guy called Arthur McMillan, who's the chief diplomatic correspondent for The National, which is, you know, kind of prestigious journalism. And I still, after all these years, this interesting disconnect between the popularity of the podcast and the fact that we have actual real listeners beyond the immediate circle of our little confraternity, which thrills me.
This is becoming too much of a love-in, so I'm going to puncture it quite severely.
Good.
Quite severely. This has been the most abusive week we've had in our tweets.
Oh, really?
No.
Well.
Why?
One in particular, but a longer correspondence, which I have no issue with whatsoever. So Liam Toland, not the Liam Toland. I love the pods, but this week's one has been utterly despicable. Never minding you Dublin boys' ignorance of rural Ireland, to say the Ballyliffin setup was disastrous is embarrassing for you, like you've never been out of Dublin, says Liam. It's a slight misrepresentation of what we said. Two of us are not even from Dublin, it's worth saying. But there was a brilliant message sent in from Steve Doherty, which I think is very, very fair, and it relates to our conversation about Ballyliffin last week. So I'll just read it out. It's a bit lengthy, but I think it's fair and it's worth reading out. Hi lads, I'm a long time friend of the pod. Hugely appreciate the work you all do on Golf Weekly. Said some other nice things, entertaining insights, shorten many a journey back to Donegal with the help of some earphones. Compliments aside, I really have had a strong reaction over the last 18 months to the general attitude the pod has had to the staging of the Irish Open at Ballyliffin last July. Let me own my impartiality here. I've been a member in Ballyliffin since I was 7 years old, and there's no doubt I might be sensitive to any negativity directed towards the club and the area. However, I feel my reactions to the pod's commentary and critique of the event moves beyond my own cognitive biases. Steve's a smart man.
Mm.
Honestly, lads, I had to let this go until I heard Joe use the word disastrous when describing the logistics of the event on the pod last week. I know it was in specific reference to the lack of bars and restaurants in the vicinity, but the general tone adds to the long list of negative comments applied to the event since it was first announced in 2017. Joe clearly has a point when comparing Ballyliffin's nightlife to the atmosphere in the streets of Killarney. It's not the point in isolation that bothers me. My grievance is in reaction to the complete lack of balance in the story that has been told on the pod about the club and the event. I really think the pod missed a beat in not detailing the story behind the tournament, how a little-known nine-hole course on the edge of Inishowen developed over the last few decades into the established 36-hole championship complex that it is today. a club that Nick Faldo tried to buy in the early 90s and defied geographical and economic odds to punch above its weight and earn the respect of the European Tour and the golfing world. You might remember when the event was initially announced, your general critiques were that crowds wouldn't travel to the event, traffic jams would be problematic, and after Nathan's trip for the media day, that the wind would make the course unplayable. Ironically, a major achievement of the week turned out to be the course's ability to stay playable due to the recent investment in a state-of-the-art irrigation system during a heat wave, while most of the country's courses were burnt to a crisp. And rather than a drop-off in crowds, just shy of 95,000 turned up for the week, which was an increase on Port Stewart, Carton House and the K-Club. The expected traffic problems didn't happen, with Dermot Gleeson reporting that the European Tour reckoned it was one of the easiest Irish Opens to organise logistically. The event brought huge pride to a relatively disadvantaged community. Green fee bookings are reportedly through the roof, and the overall economic impact on the area has been significant. To sum up, lads, there are so many stories to be told about the event. With the platform that you've had on the pod, it would be great if you could start telling some of them. Best wishes, Steve Doherty. And there ends, I think, the best correspondence we have ever had.
Just been smacked.
I think.
Got to hold our hands up. Got to hold our hands up completely.
I don't think completely.
That is.
I don't think
completely. Very, very fair.
I think he makes some fair points, but also ignores the fact we were up there for the week of the Irish Open, covered the story of Ballyliffin and the event quite a bit.
Yeah.
Like even the comment of, I was talking about the weather when I was there for the media day. What I said it was, if they got weather like that during the Irish Open, they would have a major issue, which they would have. It was absolutely horrendous. But they didn't.
No.
The conditions were perfect. But I still think you were making a slightly different point.
He does acknowledge that, to be fair.
Ballyliffin was an unbelievable course, which we mentioned countless times.
Yeah.
How good the course was.
Yeah.
There, okay, maybe there were no traffic issues. But what we were talking about last week with Paul McGinley, and I've spoken about constantly, and we always go back to Killarney, is the festival feeling as to what you want your Irish Open to be. Is it to be on the best course? Is it to be on the resort course? Is it to be on the course that pays the most amount of money? Or is it somewhere in the same place every year where people want to go and get a full-on experience?
Yeah. Like he does say, I let this go until I heard Joe use the word disastrous when describing the logistics of the event. And then he says, I know it was in specific reference to the lack of bars and restaurants in the vicinity, but then he says, it's the general tone I've had a problem with, a long list of negative comments. If that's the case, and it probably is the case, I think that's fair enough that you've called us on that. Like, I shouldn't use the word disastrous. I mean, I hope you'll all appreciate sometimes when you're chatting here, sometimes you're just looking for a word and words creep out. But, like, the nightlife was not ideal.
No,
if that's a better word than disastrous,
then
let's go with
it. It was non-existent, and like we can, you mentioned only being able to get a takeaway. Like, that is not a joke. We were staying, 20 minutes away from the Irish Open? We went to one of the closest towns, and at 8 o'clock on the Friday evening, quite literally the only place that we could get food was in a takeaway.
No, the whole town was completely shut down.
And I've spoken to lots of people who were up there who made a similar comment, who loved going to Ballyliffin, who loved the ease of access, who loved the course, the conditions, everything about it. And the one thing they would all say was, you couldn't really make a weekend of it unless you stayed in Derry. And Derry's a city where it wasn't really hosting the Irish Open, so you're just staying there like any time. There wasn't 90,000 Irish golf fans coming together in an evening or 10, 20,000.
Yeah, there was no focal point.
It was a day event.
Yeah. I accept, you know, maybe the general tone has been a bit harsh, but the criticisms still stand, but maybe we haven't played up the other aspects of the course. And I definitely can appreciate for the area, it was an amazing triumph, you know, and rightfully so. They can't help it if it's in an isolated part of the world. That said, I will prefer Killarney and the sense of festival that you will get in the town.
But Lahinch.
Sorry, yeah, Lahinch. Killarney was, yeah, Lahinch, yeah, yeah. It's a fair criticism, Fionn, probably.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, although I think Nathan's point, I couldn't agree with more. I think I don't think we ever criticised the course. I think, Nathan, you had an experience in the media day where, you know, listen, I've been going to Donegal since I was a little kid. And when the weather's horrendous, it's absolutely horrendous. And when the weather's good, it's glorious. You had a horrendous day, and then the Irish Open, the weather was beautiful. But we've never once critiqued the course. I've known the course for 20 years. It's one of the best courses in the country. But I think Nathan's point about the nightlife, the lack of festival atmosphere, I was there. I couldn't believe it, like that. You just couldn't get anything other than just like a bad takeaway on the Friday night. Yeah. And these are problems going forward. These are problems that can be reflected on. It's not a critique of the course or the course setup, or indeed the work that they've done to make the course one of the best courses in Ireland, if not Europe. But then again, as someone who has a huge fondness for Donegal, I think my friends from Donegal will admit, maybe reluctantly, that they can be a tad sensitive, given that they're often considered the ignored cousins of Ireland, you know, and that is absolutely true. Like there's a sense that Donegal is kind of the forgotten corner. It's the only county that doesn't have a rail link. It's kind of seen as kind of it's just so far away, and to the detriment of like one of the most beautiful parts of the world. Mm. So, yeah, I think, but I have to say, I think Steve's letter was very fair. I thought very measured. But I also think you're right, Joe. It's like sometimes you say disastrous, we can all be a little hyperbolic when you're just having a chat.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't imagine for a second that you actually meant it was an unmitigated disaster. No. You know, I don't think you did.
No, I wouldn't write that word. So I'll take back disastrous, but the general critique probably stands. But Steve, thank you for the long message. We appreciate it. Adrian Bain on Twitter, Wednesday Golf on TV is messing with my body clock. Way worse than jet lag, says Adrian. Anthony Coscoran, looking forward to this week's pod and presenters' picks for the final. Only Wednesday. It feels like the weekend already. Neil wonders, can Shane Lowry drop out of the top 50 this week and then not be at Augusta?
I don't think so, because of the way the world ranking points operate. So you lose points from, say, a year ago and 2 years ago. Mm. And the way it works out, he should be fine.
He lost his first match to Sergio Garcia 4-2. What I'm reading here from the Irish Independent is he must remain in the top 50 on Monday to secure his ticket to Augusta. But while he's projected to rise to 46th, given the vagaries of the system, he is still vulnerable if players from outside the top 50 have a good week. So,
yeah, he'd be looking at a scenario where players ranked 55 to 60 all end up in the quarterfinals.
Okay.
Which would be a bit of a disaster.
Brian Oliver, as many people did, pointed out our issues with stones and pens. Brooks Koepka hasn't lost 3 stone, as we said, more like a stone. 14 pounds and a stone, says Brian and several others. I hope there are no kids with maths exams coming up listening. We let ourselves down. I had it in my head with 7 pounds and a stone. Just went with it. Didn't think it
Jesus.
Through.
Jesus.
Did you not say 3 stone?
Yeah, I did. But he actually only lost a stone, Brooks Koepka.
What?
Yeah.
Ah, here. Because I saw him on some... I was like, where's he lost this weight from?
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on.
Let's move on from my terrible mistake that we spent half an hour talking about in the
podcast.
Could
say it was a disastrous mistake.
It was a disastrous mistake.
WGC Dell Technologies Match Play. PGA Tour players, by the way, have voted to maintain this format for next year's match play. Which could, by the way, see Tiger Woods play Rory McIlroy in the last 16. I think we'll have to be careful here because play is ongoing as we speak and this thing will date like nobody's business. So we won't focus too much on this. McIlroy won his first match. Woods beat Aaron Wise. Apparently it wasn't a good standard. I think we all have to agree that the new format is better. I mean, we're not looking at a host of players exiting on day one or two.
Yeah, it's slightly better. It still ends with the same scenario of Sunday is generally the least interesting day when the final is on, unless you end up with a scenario where you have McIlroy against Spieth or Mickelson, or you have two of the top 10 players playing each other. Yeah. And then, even then, it's a difficult watch because there's such long gaps between the shots.
Well, it's one to record, I think, and flick through.
And you mentioned there that they voted to maintain this. So what was put on the table, I think, was that they would do match play for the first 3 days and then it would turn into a 36-hole stroke play tournament over the Saturday and Sunday for whatever, maybe 16 players who get through. I'd imagine for those exact reasons, for television purposes. Obviously, you can't really call it a match play.
That's true.
In that case, but...
Does it float your boat, Fionn?
Yeah, I mean, it's the same old problem, isn't it? It's, as Nathan said, it's like once you get to Sundays... unless the final is between two of the marquee players, it's just dull. I mean, it's more, it's odd, and it's inverse excitement. It's when you have lots of matches on and you're flicking from one match to the other. That's where the excitement is. Mm. I like match play, though. I love the format. I have no problems with it. I just think, I don't know how to solve the problem of a final where you just have ages between shots.
I prefer the old system as well. I get the whole players having to travel halfway across the world for 18 holes and you're gone home by Wednesday evening. And but it just, like, you can remember certain matches through the years for straight up, like, who's the world number one playing the world number 64? First day, it's this huge shock. It's quite a story if Dustin Johnson gets beaten by the rank outsider. Tiger Woods gets beaten. Whereas this, you get a second chance and you just sort of float out of it on Friday and nobody's too bothered.
It does take the intensity of the initial few days away. I know there's lots of matches on. I do wonder for Sunday, I've suggested it before, I think it's not a bad idea at all. Just have them in carts for the final. I know the optics might be great, carts going down the fairways or down the cart path, but you could put cameras in the carts and get a close-up view, maybe have some tell them, look, they're going to be mic'd up carts as well. Be worth trying. It would just turn what will be 3 to 4 hours of match play into 2-3 hours. Very watchable, I think. But they won't do that. It's just the gap between shots, you know, and the third, fourth place playoff never feels that relevant.
No. The whole thing never feels that relevant.
No,
it's not like you're being crowned champion of the world because you're in the world match play.
No.
So that's ongoing. We'll talk about that next week, although really we're into Augusta preview mode next week probably. Other bits of news, Louis Westhuizen is coming to Lahinch. I'm thrilled with this, I have to say. He says, I'm really looking forward to getting back to Ireland, playing links again. Last played the Irish Open in 2009. I'll spend the week playing links golf, the week in between taking a break with the family. I'll drive around Ireland. I'll go along the west coast all the way up to Portrush. So Louis Westhuizen is doing exactly the right thing, I think, in preparation for Portrush. I'm excited because I don't think he'll draw massive crowds. I mean, he won't have the casual golf fan kind of desperate to see him, but I am desperate to see him because his swing is just a little slice of heaven. And he's a small man. Like, you can kind of relate to him a little bit. He's not like Dustin Johnson, who's as flexible as a gymnast and athletic. Like, we've no chance of even relating to that. But Louis Westhuizen's just a small, normal fella. Not that physically impressive, but my God, the swing is amazing.
And very likable.
He is a likable fella, yeah. So that's a big, that's a good one. That's a really nice one.
He wouldn't have told us that last Thursday, would he?
No. Keeping his cards close to his chest there, McGinley. Robert Garrigus, the other piece of news. 22-year professional career, Robert Garrigus. He's just a single tour victory, the odd appearance in majors, 41 years of age now. And he has, in fairness to the fella, received clinical help for substance abuse in 2003. But he's been banned for 3 months. He failed a test. The tour described it as a drug of abuse. And then he released a statement. After a long period of sobriety, I've had a relapse and subsequently failed a drugs test for marijuana. A drug that, although legal in many states, is not permitted under the PGA Tour's anti-doping rules. I mention it's legal in many states, not as an excuse, but as a word of warning to many people who use or try marijuana. Legal does not mean it's not addictive. And legal doesn't mean there aren't potentially severe consequences if you use it. The tour's stance on marijuana, by the way, is that athletes are unlikely to use cannabinoids to improve their performance. However, some athletes have used cannabinoids to decrease anxiety before competition. They're more likely to be used as a recreational drug. I think it's significant because the Garrigus case is pretty much the big public one of a reported ban for recreational drug use since the PGA Tour changed its stance. Up until 2017, late 2017, the tour only revealed bans for performance-enhancing breaches of policy. So now they've changed that rule. So if there is recreational drug use, it will be made public. So Garrigus is going to serve some kind of ban.
So if somebody was banned for 6 months for cocaine use, we would be told about it?
Correct. And there obviously have been suspicions before that we've seen players disappear for several months. And we can't name names, but there were always those rumours. But now if that happens, then yeah, it will be public. As it should be, really. You feel sorry for a guy like Garrigus. I mean,
well, it means he's no longer best known for Swamp Ass. Wasn't Robert Garrigus Swamp Ass?
Describe.
You know what Swamp Ass is?
I'm sure I'll remember.
When they're playing in the, it must have been part of the Florida Swing, and the humidity is pretty intense.
I think I tweeted a picture.
And you're in contention, and you get a bit wet around the crotchal and ass area.
Yeah.
Sort of sweat, sort of...
gathers.
Gathers. And Robert Garrigus suffered that fate, but probably about 5 years ago.
Right.
He was just wearing the wrong colour pants. Sort of a mustard colour pants that really brought the best out of the swamp ass.
I remember, I'm curious though, the PGA Tour stance on cannabinoids and saying, oh, that some might use marijuana to relax beforehand is like, I don't know about you boys, but I'll tell you one thing. I wouldn't be able to swing a golf club stoned. Just not going to happen.
Really? Why?
Because you get very mellow. And,
but presumably he wasn't stoned on the course.
Oh, I don't know. No. There's no suggestion he was using it as a performance enhancing.
No, but it's not a performance enhancing drug. I mean, and like if you get, so let's say you smoke 2 days beforehand and then you show up and play around. Like there's no lingering after effect. There's no, I mean, other than that it's still in your system. Like, but you're not mellow because you smoked a couple of joints the day before or 2 days earlier. So the relationship between smoking marijuana and improvements on the course is entirely non-existent. But I realize that that's not entirely the point. I kind of feel for him. And, you know, for a guy, if he's battling substance abuse, that's a whole other issue, isn't it? That's a whole other problem.
Well, but, on that theme, poor old David Faraday. So he did a big interview with HBO's Brian Gumbel in a Real Sports interview, which is aired summer of 2017. He lost his son Shay to an overdose. And Faraday's talking about just how difficult it's been for him. Like, really tough. I think we all really like David Faraday. He says, I apologise to him every day. I'm sorry, son. I wasn't there. I wasn't there. I was always gone. Times that I was drunk, the times that I was high, they could have been times I would have spent with him. And it seems Shay's death sent Faraday into a spiral, forced a relapse of his own. I was at a friend's ranch. I'd gone up there by myself. I thought, you know what? I've been sober 10 years. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of being sober. I want to feel better. And I convinced myself it would make me feel better. So there was a bottle of Irish whiskey there, which is like an angel crying on my tongue. But oddly enough, it tasted awful, but I made myself drink more. I thought, hey, I've got this under control. I don't need to drink that much. You know, the next day I did the same thing and I thought, well, I've got it under control. But before I knew it, it had me under control again, which is really tough. But he seems to have got through that little phase, Faraday. But that's an interview that's aired in the States just in the last week or so. There's a great piece he did with John Feinstein, last year, which you could check out. And he talks at length about his son and the whole situation. He was lost in so many ways, reminded me a lot of me, which is just one of the reasons I can't help but feel devastated and guilty about what happened to him. It's mad, isn't it? You watch Faraday commentating and there's almost a carefree quality to his demeanour. And yet there's so much going on with this guy behind the scenes. You just hope he gets on top of it again. And look, the death of his son is never going to be easy for him.
No, I think it's fairly understandable.
Yeah.
His TV program's on Sky now.
That's right, yeah.
Which, it's a bit American. It's a bit too slick and chummy. But he still gets the odd decent. He gets good guests.
Great guests.
Actually, yeah. The stuff with the European Tour players is a lot better than the Americans.
Why is that, do you think?
I think they're just a bit more chilled and a bit more honest and sort of used to telling the truth, whereas the Americans are just so well versed.
He's done some mad ones where, like, Bubba Watson was showing him his car collection, and he's done Donald Trump, Bill Clinton. He's had some big names on it. That's good, it's in Sky. I must check it out. I keep meaning to watch it more, but I don't actually get a chance.
It's on repeat, don't you worry about that.
I'm sure it is. Yeah. So that's Faraday, that's what's going on with him. We should mention Paul Casey won the Valspar, just his third PGA Tour win, the age of 41.
Yeah, did well. He's the first back-to-back winner in the 19 years. He won it last year with a 65. He was 5 shots behind last year, but he had it 1 over 72 on Sunday. He played well. I mean, nobody really played well, but he played well in very tough conditions. And he was a bit unlucky. Oosthuizen and Kokrak were a bit unlucky. They both had a chance to take it, but just didn't manage to get up and down. Yeah, it was a good win, I thought. I hadn't watched it, and then I watched it on Sunday just to kind of see. But
He said himself he's back playing as well as when he was third in the world. So he's really got back to what he was doing a number of years ago. He went through off course issues. I think there was a divorce and just various bits and bobs. And his coach is Konica, that guy.
Peter Costas.
Peter Costas has worked with him,
Okay.
Yeah, I heard Costas been interviewed about him, and he said that Casey really went away from what he did well. They've got him back doing that now.
I always sort of half assumed that Costas was just talking about him in his role as a commentator.
Mm, no.
Dustin Johnson fairly imploded in the final round. Not a single birdie.
No.
If that was Rory, we'd be slating him.
This is true.
We would.
This is true.
He's really fallen off the edge, hasn't he, Dustin, in the last 18 months, 2 years? Like, I don't mean he's disappeared.
He did win a month ago and twice. He's won twice this year. Mm. This is what Dustin Johnson does. Like, he goes and wins in Saudi Arabia, destroys a really good field, comes back to the States, destroys another field, and we all just forget it instantly. It's a really interesting thing.
Yeah.
He's world number one in the world.
But what I meant is that 2 years ago, he was on the edge of establishing himself as a multiple major winner. And we thought it was just a matter of time before he'd put the foot down and, you know, before he'd have four majors under his belt. And
oh, he's the great underachiever.
And then he fell down the stairs.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. And
Paul Casey's got to be a good shout for the Masters now. Has a really good record around Augusta.
Yeah.
Over the last few years, has put himself thereabouts without ever contending. As you say, he's only won three times on the PGA Tour, which is the one big criticism that, like, you still think back to the 2010 Open at St. Andrews in that final round with Westhuizen. Westhuizen has this lead and he just looks happy to be there. Mm. Never put any pressure on him. Remember him walking down the first couple of fairways, chatting away, laughing. You're thinking, no, you need to be a killer here. You need to somehow unsettle Westhuizen. And it was probably the easiest round of Westhuizen's life.
Yeah, it was a procession. He's a fair shade for the Masters. Will you be so brainwashed that you're going to still have a nibble on Jordan Spieth around Augusta?
I'm hoping that somebody, one of the favourites, wins the match play this week, so Spieth will go out yet again. If Spieth goes over 25-1, I don't care. He's still a good bet around Augusta. He's only had one top 10 since last year's Masters.
Mm. Yeah.
It's suddenly gone from it's coming back to, ooh, this is a full-blown slump.
It's a problem now. It is.
Oh, yeah. Did you see his, he had a half yesterday. Like, he fought really hard to get it. Was he three down or five down or whatever off the in the first, rallied back, then shot like a bunch of bogeys, but then finished with a bunch of birdies to just eke out this half. And he turned it around and said, really good sign, really good sign. Right. I'm battling, I'm working well. He's a far cry from the Jordan Spieth of 3 years ago, isn't he?
Like, it will be a bet just based on nostalgia and unspoken sense.
Horses for courses, and he is inspires him. Probably the best player around Augusta. Just having a quick look at his odds. 18-1.
He'll be out to over 20s.
Seventh favourite. Mm. Rory, DJ, Justin Rose, Tiger Woods, Justin Thomas, John Rahm, and then Jordan Spieth is on the same odds as Ricky Fowler, Bryson DeChambeau and Brooks Koepka.
What odds is Rory?
Rory is 7-1.
As favourite, joint favourite.
As favourite. Dustin Johnson at 9-1. Paul Casey, 28-1.
Yeah. You wanted to mention Matt Kuchar?
I did. Peace has broken out at last, lads.
What?
Yes. El Toucan and Matt are friends again. Apparently they met in the clubhouse dining room at the end of February at the WGC in Mexico. They had, and I'm quoting here, over a 40-minute glass of morning orange juice. Okay.
It's a lot of vitamin C.
Who paid for
it? I know. Ortiz said that Matt came up and went, "Hey, David, how are you?" And then Ortiz, "I apologize for the difficulty the situation created. I told him it was never my intention to embarrass him, but I felt eventually I had to tell the truth. Matt also offered an apology. He said it was all a misunderstanding. He asked me how my family was. Fine, all the better now that we're whatever X amount of money richer." That's just me adding that bit. Oh. He showed me, and then I like this. He showed me a picture of his family and a video of a hole-in-one made by one of his sons. Oh. Ortiz said, and you'll enjoy this now, there were four people at the breakfast table, including a sports psychologist who, quote, is very close to Matt. I like it because I read the story and it's like there's so much in there really to parse.
Are any of you in the habit of showing people photos of your family?
No. Really.
I find
unless
if someone,
they ask.
If someone shows me a photo of their family, I'm inclined to go, oh, that's a beautiful...
What do you want to see their family for?
I don't want it. No, but it's just interesting but they're showing each other.
It's his son photos. Getting a hole in one.
Well, it was just because
like
it got awkward and they didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
Well, look, I'm thrilled for them. God, I'd say, can you imagine how much Matt Kuchar hates this guy?
Can you imagine everybody else in the clubhouse going,
I'd say.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. What's your issue with the psychologist with Matt?
Oh, no,
what,
it's
you
not.
Reading something deeper into it?
Well, it's just curious that the fact that Ortiz would mention that there was a sports psychologist there led me to infer, perhaps wrongly, was the sports psychologist the one who prompted Matt Kuchar? He goes, okay, so this is the tone you need to take. No, you can't tell him that he's an absolute dickhead and he's gone. No, this is what I would say.
Yeah.
It reminded me of, have either of you seen the Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster?
Yes. Yeah.
Do you remember when the psychologist is there to negotiate a conversation between Lars Ulrich and James Hatfield?
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I was thinking. Is the psychologist trying to mediate between two guys who are desperately uncomfortable, don't really want to talk to each other, and I'm not suggesting for a second that this is what happened, but it's one of my favorite moments in some kind of monster where Lars Ulrich is going, so no, and the guy's going, no, tell him how you. I feel I want to tell him to go fuck himself.
That is a great analogy.
Yeah.
I'm not in the habit of like pushing other podcasts because why would we? But I just have to direct Friends of the Pod to the No Lay No podcast interview with Steve Elkington.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
It is unmissable.
Why?
Because Steve Elkington, who's obviously, you know...
a bollocks.
Yeah, you could definitely have that interpretation. It's like he is not being recorded. He's just
talking. Brilliant. Okay,
He's just honest. Some highlights include things like, well, look, Phil, you know, I gave Phil his nickname on tour. And they're like, what's that? He's like, Hefty.
Wow.
None of this lefty. And then he was like, the thing about Phil, look, Phil's just a giant nerd. Phil, look, he's the most disingenuous man I've ever met. Phil's been an asshole for 25 years, but he's been great for the game. You know, I love him as a player, but he's the most disingenuous man I've ever met.
Brilliant.
Wow.
Okay. I take
it all back. He's not a bollocks.
Well, he is, you know, because he's telling stories about Monty one day and he's like, oh my God. He tells a story about like match play against Monty at Wentworth and he starts talking. They were like, there was an interval. There was like a castle, a custard cream kind of castle of Wentworth. And Monty went over and just like destroyed it and started putting it all on his plate. And he was like sitting with his wife, Elkington. He's like, there's no way that's all for him. Like, surely he's going to bring over like 12 spoons for the table. And he's like, no. Monty went over with his own spoon and ate the whole castle. And Elkington turned to his wife and said, no man who eats that much custard is going to beat me this evening.
Fantastic.
He loves Monty as well. But he's like, I remember going into Monty once. And I was looking, either it was in his golf cart or his car. I can't remember. It was very late last night when I was listening. And he goes, and there were four empty Big Mac boxes in the car. He's like, who eats four Big Macs? Seriously. Monty does.
Wow.
So
fantastic.
It's as a recommendation to our fellow friends of the pod, you kind of have to listen to it.
There was one other thing I did want to mention.
I'm skipping the ads though.
Oh yeah. It's definitely not unmissable every week.
Did either of you?
We've done one of our least interesting podcasts ever
of all time.
30 minutes. Yeah, ever. I'm a little under the weather. Sorry, I'm not
so
my best self today. It's been a busy
week. Me both.
Steve Elkington.
Are you okay, Fionn?
I don't know. I've just come down with something, and I'm not feeling great. Before we go, did either of you see Woods's interview or pre-tournament press conference at the WGC when he was asked about? He was asked to describe the level of competition in 2019, and his answer was, and I'm quoting, "I think equipment has made it smaller. The margin is much smaller than it used to be. You look at the new heads, these 460 cubic centimeters. You hit the ball anywhere in the face and it goes 300 yards. Before, it put a premium on good ball strikers to hit the ball in the middle of the face each and every time. And there was a distinction between the guys who would do that and the guys who couldn't. And that's no longer the case. Mm. It promotes people swinging harder, teeing the ball higher, swinging harder and hitting the ball further. And the old shot of hitting just a squeezier, low, heely cut in play, that's no longer the case. Guys are trying to maximize distance off the tee to try and carry that number 300, 320, 330 in the air. And it's become a game that's played more up in the air than it ever used to be, which you can see that as one of two things. It's the old guy who's, you know, it's the classic thing. As a guy kind of goes over the hill, they invariably start complaining about technology. Or Tiger Woods has finally said something genuinely revealing about how he sees. Now, I don't think there's any surprises. I think we know that club face technology has made it easier for guys to hit the ball much further and the sweet spot has just gotten much bigger. But I thought it was interesting that Tiger Woods would say something to that effect. Mm.
Yeah, very interesting. I'd be inclined to go with the latter. I think he's been genuine.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, they say like Greg Norman, this amazing driver, that real strength of his would be
nullified.
To a point, yeah. Like, there's just so many guys who are able to not worry about accuracy as much and vomit. There is a pretty big sweet spot. Clubs are forgiving. There's no way back, though, is there?
No.
I think, like, that ship has sailed.
Or just all of a sudden just say, okay, from now on, that the driver club face can't be more than 360 cubic centimetres. Mm. Or you, whatever, you reduce it. You just pick a number and say that's how big they have to be.
Would you be in favour of making equipment more or less user-friendly for the pros and more user-friendly for amateurs?
Oh, that's a good question. I think for the pros, there's how long can a golf course get?
Exactly.
So you either, because the technology is exponentially improving, isn't it? Or maybe not exponentially, but it's certainly getting better in leaps and bounds. So unless you include, like similar to getting rid of anchored putting, if you say, okay, we're going to limit the development of the club face on a driver or on any wood to kind of restrict these massive big sweet spots and these 340-yard bombs that it seems that every player is capable of hitting. Yeah, and then for amateurs, I don't know. Yeah, have a different set for amateurs.
Yeah,
I think that's not a bad shout.
Yeah. All righty. Let's wrap this up. We've got Augusta around the corner.
So it'll be better next week. We promise.
We promise. We cannot be this bad. It's a down week. We save ourselves for the majors, the big weeks.
That's it.
So are we doing a Masters Day? No. Yes, maybe. Unlikely.
We'll see.
Less likely than likely?
I don't know. We'll have to talk about it.
We'll have to talk about it soon.
You're probably right.
All righty. So enjoy the match play. We'll be back next week. I guess we're into Masters mode next week, so we'll talk to you then. Cheers.
Starter kit right here.